Welcome to Dead Writer Drama, where we talk about the professional feuds, sex scandals, messy public breakups, and controversial legacies of history's literary legends, brought to you by the American Writers Museum.
Hi, I'm Allison Sansoni, Program Director at the American Writers Museum, sitting in for our regular co-host, Zakiya Dalila-Harris.
And I'm Jennifer Cation Armstrong. I've written 7 books about pop culture history, including the New York Times bestseller Seinfeldia and When Women Invented Television.
Today, we're discussing Nathaniel Hawthorne, a transcendentalist from Salem, Massachusetts, who's best known for his novel, The Scarlet Letter. His writing largely shaped popular images of 19th century New England and had a strong anti-Puritan streak. Through his works of dark romanticism, he explored themes of morality, evil, and sin.
The New York Times, May 20th, 1864. The Telegraph brings us the mournful and unexpected news of the death of the most charming of American novelists and one of the foremost descriptive writers in the language. Nathaniel Hawthorne was found dead in his bed yesterday morning at Plymouth, New Hampshire, where, in the companionship of one or more of his earliest friends, he was spending some days for the benefit of his health. Mr. Hawthorne was all but 60 years of age, having been born at Salem, Massachusetts on the 4th of July, 1804. Of his ancestry, the current biographies profess to find records in the witch-burning era of Salem, and by the same authorities, he is affiliated to a line of seafaring colonists who combined the pursuits of agriculture and commerce on a scale of uncertain magnitude, but with steady perseverance. The salient points in his private and official life are briefly these. His father having died at Havana in 1810, young Hawthorne was shortly afterward put under the charge of a farmer near Sebago Lake, Maine, chiefly with a view to the recruitment of his health, which was delicate. He entered Bowdoin College, Maine, where Franklin Pierce and George B. Cheever were his fellow students, in 1825, and at the close of his collegiate career, he settled at Salem. Fortune, sometime later, in 1838, found him a government position as a gauger in the Boston Custom House under Mr. Bancroft, then the collector at that port during the Van Buren administration. When the Whigs came into power in 1841, Hawthorne lost his appointment and conceiving, probably like Southey, Coleridge, and Lovell, the idea of a pantocracy, he joined the famous Brook Farm Association, returning, however, fully satisfied with his experience of a perfect state of society to Boston in 1843. Here he married and made his home, subsequently for some years in the Old Manse at Concord, Massachusetts.
Hawthorne's literary life commenced at Salem on the close of his college days. Leading for several years almost the life of a recluse, he here produced a series of sketches, tales, and romances, some of which were found worthy of revival in his mature years under the title of Twice Told Tales. Then followed, after his retirement from the Boston Gagership, the papers called Mosses from an Old Manse, succeeded by the most widely known of all of his works, The Scarlet Letter, in 1850. By the House of Seven Gables in 1851, by the Blithesdale Romance in 1852, by the Marble Faun in 1859, and by Our Old Home, his last work, in 1863. His minor sketches would be difficult of enumeration. They continued to grace the pages of the best contemporary periodicals occasionally up to the time of his death. Hawthorne, in his sudden and comparatively early death, was saved the most awful of miseries that can befall the aspirant for permanent renown, that of seeing the honor and glory of youth extinguished in his own presence. The force of beauty and of reason were conspicuous in all he did to the last. A profound apprehensiveness of truth, a deep sincerity and unvarying kindness uniformly to the end, restrained and modulated his facile humor.
We need to talk about Nathaniel Hawthorne from our own experience a little bit. I assume that you know, you must have read it in high school or whatever, like everyone else, right? I mean, this is one that I don't think ever is under question.
No, no. I feel like there's a very base, it has an unassailable place in the, you know, the American literary canon, where, you know, you read, what do you read? Well, you read The Scarlet Letter to understand both Puritanism and the forces that eventually overcame it. But I feel like a lot of it was, I feel like a lot of what Hawthorne was going through, you know, had we back-ended it with that, had we started with some of the facts of his life and what led him to write it, I feel like it would have been a much, much more effective lesson.
Right, which is what we talk with our guest about today. He makes it much more exciting. I really wish that I had learned about Hawthorne from him. He's turning the lights down in his classrooms. He's doing all kinds of things for dramatic effect. He's talking about the man's life, where he came from. And I think that makes a huge difference.
Yeah. I think the influences around a writer sometimes, especially when that writer is young, are incredibly important. And Hawthorne was surrounded by all of these fascinating people who changed the way that he thought about things. You know, they questioned him, they let him talk to them, they influenced him in so many different ways that, you know, The Scarlet Letter didn't come out of nowhere. It came out of his learning and his life. And I feel like that this book really places that context around these, you know, these literary classics, and sheds a lot of light on what Hawthorne was going through, as well as, you know, what he was creating in his writing.
Well, and as you and I were kind of talking about before recording, you know, he was this very romantic, Byronic figure. I completely relate to him in a different way now, having learned more about his life. I feel like I totally would have dated him if I was in, you know, 1800s New England. This is a very emo young male writer. We know this story well, and we always, you know, I always loved these guys. I know that there's just a draw of this kind of like dark, mysterious, brooding writer.
He had a very dashing figure. And, you know, if you ran into him at one of Thoreau's readings, you would be instantly charmed, because he would be lurking in the back and not talking with anyone. And you'd want to know what was going on in his head. And when I read the stories about him, you know, his early career, he publishes this, you know, the semi-autobiographical novel, and then hates it so much. Yes. That he has all of the copies confiscated and burned. I was thinking about all of the, you know, you hear about, you know, all of these writers who are like, oh, I hope my mom didn't save my embarrassing teenage poetry. There's a complete through line to that. The writer process is the same now as it was. It was then. You write something incredibly confessional and you hope it never sees the light of day.
I get that. I mean, I wrote a novel that was never published. And I am so glad that it was not published. So I totally relate to that. And I would not want someone putting it out now. So that all of it, this is why we're here, because, you know, in the end you find out, you know, we're all writers. They're just like us.
they're people.
Also, I just want to briefly shout out that amazing New York Times obituary. I don't think we've done anyone this early before. No. And so it's this whole other style of writing an obituary. It's very dramatic. It befits the man.
Well, and as our guest gets into a little bit later, you really have to take a step in order to get to the substance. You really have to get comfortable with the style. Mm-hmm. You have to get over that initial, what are all these $50 words? And why is the sentence, you know, 15 lines long? And where is the punctuation? You just have to, you know, you have to get past all of that and sort of fall into the rhythm of the language from that time. And once you do, the beauty of it really starts to emerge. But oh boy, is it a lot for people raised on late 20th century realism.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So please enjoy our conversation with Dale Selweck. Our guest today, Dale Sawag, has taught English literature at Citrus College in Glendora, California since 1973, and has also published 25 books, including the forthcoming The Life of the Author, Nathaniel Hawthorne. He's also an accomplished magician, a regular performer at the Magic Castle in Los Angeles, who's known as the Gentleman of Magic.
I will start us off. So welcome to Dead Writer Drama, Dale Sawag. Am I pronouncing your last name correctly?
Yes, that's correct.
All right. Wonderful. I wanted to start, first of all, I finished the book last night and loved it. And I wanted to start by asking, you know, at the beginning of the book, you describe Hawthorne as a mysterious figure. And I'm wondering why he's mysterious and what drew you to his story?
Well, let me answer the second part first, and then that'll lead to the first part. What drew me to the story really goes back to when I was just a youngster, 10 years old, living in Amherst, Massachusetts. And my parents took my brother and me to Salem, Massachusetts. And among the places that we visited were was the House of the Seven Gables. And I picked up a copy of that book, The House of the Seven Gables, Hawthorne's second significant novel, his third actual novel, and was just mesmerized by the opening of it, probably because I had visited the house before I started reading the book. And something about the mystery and the darkness and the suspenseful feeling that I had walking through that house attracted me to wanting to know more about the man whose voice I heard in the novel. So the short order answer is I connected the voice of the novel with the man himself. And I think that when we develop an interest in authors and go back to those authors, in large part, it's because we fall in love with the voice or attracted by the voice. And that's what it was that drew me in. And then I started to learn more about his life, particularly his relationship with his wife, Sophia. And that intrigued me ever more. And so it's been a lifelong journey, really, of reading and studying and visiting the places associated with Hawthorne, and then, of course, teaching him to a brand new generation, many of whom are unacquainted with Hawthorne, outside of perhaps The Scarlet Letter, which was forced on them in high school.
It really comes through in your book, your personal connection to him and your sort of passion for telling people about him. I was wishing that I had learned about him from you in school.
Well, thank you for that. That I owe that to the publishers and Richard Bradford, who's the series editor. They wanted to initiate a new biographical approach, which is, as you say, more personal, less encumbered with literary theory. And this seemed to be right up my alley. And I sent to Richard in 2018 a one paragraph approach and said, does this sound like what you're looking for? And he said, that's exactly what we're looking for. So then it developed from there. I think it was a project waiting to be written. I've known all my life that I wanted to do something on Hawthorne. I just had to wait for the right timing. And also I had to be in the right place for it.
You mentioned, you know, kind of falling in love with his work, actually being in the place, you know, that was the setting for one of his works. Can you talk about his sense of place, which I always think, like, I mean, this guy more than most authors is so associated with specific places and evoked the sense of place. How did he create that in his writing?
Certainly. Well, born and raised in Salem, of course, and I knew Salem well to begin with. I was connected with it from my boyhood. And so the place came alive for me in his writings, his early short stories, for example. And of course, the House of Seven Gables, which is an actual place that he knew as a boy, and The Scarlet Letter, set in Salem as well. His descriptive powers are so magisterial, so strong, so visual, a technique, a skill that he developed through the help of his wife, Sophia, who was quite an esteemed and established artist herself and helped him with the visual aspects of it. So he captures the sights, the smells, the sounds, even the texture of life in Salem, for example. And anybody who knows Salem at all or has been there immediately connects with that feeling that comes through the books. This is a man who's not writing about something secondhand, but firsthand. It's obvious that he knows the place inside out and celebrates that in his books. I've had an interest in place all my life. It brings history to life, alive for me. I've sat on more beds and sat at more desks than you can imagine, where authors died or were born, or where they looked out windows. And so I did with Hawthorne. I traced his steps. And a lot of my preliminary thinking for the book actually developed when I was in Wayside or in the Manse, for example, or in the House of Seven Gables, or in the house where he was born. It just brought the life and the times alive for me. And that's been an interest of mine since childhood. As I say, I connect place with history. One of my students one time, I said in class that I had to go back to Concord to finish a chapter on a book I was working on. And he said, "Why bother? That's why we have the internet." Well, then I talked for 20 minutes of how the bloodless internet doesn't bring places alive. You really got to be there and smell and feel it and the texture of it. Just walking the grounds and retracing his footsteps brings the entire scene and setting and life to life for me.
Speaking of that setting, when you were writing about his early life, he was raised in this very Puritan milieu, but then he rebelled against it and he even changed his name to distance himself from his family's history. Can you tell us a little bit about that and how that happened?
Yes. He referred to in one of his letters as Puritan haunted. In fact, I use that in the early chapter. And now whether this was just a force he felt or a curse, he was never certain, but he had ancestors who were at the middle of the Salem witch trials, for example, and consigned to their deaths many, many people, as you know, during that horrific time. And Hawthorne felt that a weight of that past, the burden of the past, as Jonathan Bate calls it, upon himself. And while he knew he wasn't responsible for those horrific times, nevertheless, he felt that it had been transmitted from generation to generation. He was carrying them on his back, so to speak, and had to do something about them. So in a way, a lot of his writing is an attempt to exorcise himself, if we can put it that way, of that spirit of the past that was so judgmental, so self-righteous, so cruel to certain segments of the population. And tangibly, a way of separating himself from that when he came to his own, when he reached the age of reason, was to change his spelling of his name from Hawthorne without an E, as it was originally spelled, to adding an E to it.
It was a sort of, it seemed like a sort of symbolic casting off of this curse, this history. He was pushing it away from himself.
Very much so, yes.
He hated his first novel. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, Fanshawe is best we can tell based upon his experiences in college, Bowdoin College. And it tells the story of a young man very much like Hawthorne himself, who was rather reclusive, quite contemplative, and given to the intellectual life, the life of the student from morning to night. And into his life is introduced a young woman who offers balance through love. And by the end of the novel, he cannot receive that, can't accept that. And he dies prematurely from what Hawthorne refers to as an overstudious life. That there's a subject that interested Hawthorne a great deal was overdevelopment of the intellect to the exclusion of the heart, what later he'll be calling the unpardonable sin. And he was such a man that is Fanshawe, such a young student, probably suggestive of inclinations in Hawthorne himself. I get the sense throughout his life that he fought to keep a balance between the intellect and the heart, between the mind and the heart. And he found a way to do that through his writing and, of course, through his family and his marriage. Sophia was a great help in helping him stay balanced. The novel is based on a true event. One of his fellow students who died young, hadn't even graduated, and died from conclusions Hawthorne came to of an overstudious life devoted to books and separated from, exclusive of a more balanced life with other people and love interests and so forth. He hated the book. And there are all kinds of reasons why he may have that I explore, but I come to the conclusion that probably he hated the book because he realized that he had revealed too much of himself, what he calls the inmost me. And so he ordered all copies burned. But fortunately for all of us, about 12 years after his death, a surviving copy was discovered and it was subsequently republished. And we're glad we have it now. But I can sense throughout the book that Hawthorne's tiptoeing a little too deeply into who he is, revealing too much of himself. And that helps to explain probably why he rejected it. His wife, Sophia, to her dying day, never agreed to or admitted to that he had written that book.
I mean, I can understand also just hating your first novel. So
yeah, well, sure. Sure. The first book is autobiographical, isn't it?
And when you started talking about it, I was like, yeah, this just sounds like so many young men's first novels, right?
Even the physical description of Fanshawe, Byronically Hampson, is very much Hawthorne himself, always dressed in black, reclusive. You see him in the shadows of life in the background, which was the young Hawthorne as well.
He really missed his calling as an emo goth teenager, didn't he?
Yes, yes.
Yeah. He, you know, I thought of that when I was reading about, you know, his life after that. You know, he's what we think of as a very stereotypical young writer life. So he's living in an attic, he's sinking into despair, he's using this darkness to sort of fuel his short stories. But he actually managed to create beauty and productivity out of all of that. Mm. So it wasn't just performative for him.
That's true, but we mustn't overstate the darkness, as I have an entire chapter devoted to that. I think it's been his melancholy, his darkness, depression is overemphasized in a lot of the early biographies. And he admits himself in some of the letters that it was a splendid time for him. He called it his dismal castle, but that's not necessarily negative. It was a time of 12 years of reclusiveness, yes, so he's trying to discover himself and through his writing, but he looked back upon those times as really where he discovered his fame, discovered himself. He needed to be alone.
And we tend to romanticize that stuff, right? Do you think that that's part of why that was so emphasized in some of those earlier biographies of him?
I think so. And then consider the times. Mm-hmm. Socially and culturally what was occurring, and also the seasons. I came from Massachusetts, and the days end soon, early, and the autumnal darkness in which Hawthorne did his best writing. I think it's just partly the place. I make the point in the book that he could never have written what he wrote in fluorescent lighting or in the sunshine of California. He needed the deep, dark shadows of antiquity and place, which inspired him, opened him up. In my classes, I subdue my lighting. I get joked about on the campus, but I find that if all the lights are on, my first reaction is, what are they hiding? If you want to hide something, hide it in plain sight, all the lights on. So my lights are subdued about 30, 40%. And I find the students relax, are more self-reflective, more vulnerable. And I think that translates to understanding Hawthorne as well, that that darkness promoted his creativity.
I'm going to be thinking about this for a while now, just in terms of like all authors that I read, right? Where did they live? When did they write this?
Sure.
Was there daylight savings time? You know,
he would have been a very different writer had he lived in New Mexico.
Oh, very much so. Yes, indeed. Well, we know, don't we, that literature is a product of the times and the place. Mm-hmm. Herman Melville could never have written Moby Dick in Indiana or right. In San Diego.
He was married under the witness of a mesmerist. Can you tell us about that?
Yes, that's a curious episode. The mesmerist appears off and on in his books as well. the closest term we have for that is a hypnotist today. That goes back to Sophia. Sophia suffered from an early age with recurring migraine headaches, among other ailments, probably the result of mercury poisoning. As you know, in the 19th century, often treatment for anything from arthritis to migraines was injection of mercury. And so the cure or the treatment was worse than the illness. Louisa May Alcott, same thing, affected her that way. So the mesmerist was one of the many attendees who had an intimate involvement in Sophia's early life and was there as an observer, as a witness, and as a close member of the family recommended by her father, who was a dentist, regrettably. But mesmerist did help her in relaxation. She was anxiety prone, we know that. And it helped her to relax and to come into herself. And Hawthorne makes use of that image of the mesmerist in quite a number of his stories and novels as well, as an important sign of the times, a reflection of the culture, and a means, an alternative to the medicine and the science of the times.
His greatest success, obviously, and what he's known for today is The Scarlet Letter. And when it came out, reviewers described it as quintessentially American. What made it so American to them?
I use the cliche question to answer that. How much time do you have? That's 3 weeks of discussion in my class. There's so much. Obviously, first and foremost is that it's where it's set, Salem and its history, and the history is replete throughout the book. Salem, Hawthorne is responding to, reacting to the history, which could be a curse upon him, that the Puritan haunted Salem. And here we have Hester Prynne, who's the opposite of the stereotypical woman of 19th century and early of colonial times. She's very much a modern woman. So in some ways, this is quite a risky book that Hawthorne had written and published, because it runs counter to the times. But that makes it quintessentially American, doesn't it? Ralph Waldo Emerson said in The American Scholar that we need to break away from European and from English influences and find our own voice. And so what makes it quintessentially American is it's so original. It's the first, really, the first to break through. And as Henry James said, this is an American novel. This is what America is. This is the American voice. So that would be the second answer to your question, is just the voice that he's speaking with is distinctly American. It's not an English voice. It's not a European voice. It's an American voice that reflects the culture of the times, the early years. The country is only, 23 million when he's writing, but it's just, a few thousand, ten of thousands when the novel is set. Quintessentially American because its themes are American. Sin, guilt, sexual identity, to start there. The competition between men and women, witchcraft, there's a witch that pops up every so often in the book, that too. But that's a start anyway, answer to your question. It feels American, and that's easy to say if we know what it means to be an American.
Yeah, it's raised in opposition to the status quo. It's questioning.
Yeah.
You talk in the introduction too about kind of how some of your students often scoff at learning Hawthorne, like, how is he relevant to today? Whereas I feel like, my goodness, I can't think of a novel from that time that feels more relevant in a lot of ways. What do you think about that?
Well, I agree with you. What they're really reacting to is not so much the storyline as the style. It takes a chapter or two to develop the years. Mm-hmm. So I have them read on their own out loud the first chapter or two to get used to Hawthorne's style. And then once they're used to it, then they are comfortable with it. Any literature that's out of our time, probably we need to do that. In my Shakespeare class, it takes a while to get used to Elizabethan English. But develop the ears for it after a while. And I think the same is true for Hawthorne. We have to slow down also. Mm. It's not a quick read, The Scarlet Letter. got to take our time. This is not TMZ that we're looking at. So read a few pages reflectively and think about it. I do think that's primarily, it's not so much the subject matter, because as I argue in the book, what Hawthorne concerns himself with is what we all concern ourselves with. In all of my students is a hunger for seriousness, as Philip Larkin once said. Mm-hmm. And by serious, I don't mean maudlin, but rather what's essential. Surely there's more to life than what we see. Mm-hmm. We're all concerned about issues of eternity. Somewhere at some point, the issue of spirituality arises in our life for conversation, sexual identity, obviously, rebellion against society, secrets, the effect of secrets on our lives. Those are all essential concerns that every student without exception thinks about at times. Just gotta get into the style of it.
Well, and you mentioned TMZ, and I'm kind of laughing because I feel like there's a little bit of a parallel there even, right? There's a lot, this is a lot about judgment. It's a lot about judgment of women, yes, certain kinds of women, and TMZ does all of that.
So. Yes.
holding people up for condemnation based on, yes, supposed,
oh,
behavior.
I thought we were in an enlightened era now.
And yes.
It's so
and
surprising.
Yes. You mentioned Melville. We have to talk about his friendship with Melville. He was intimate with Melville on an almost spiritual level. Mm-hmm. What do you think drew them to one another? And can you talk a little bit about the speculation that passion for each other was more than simply professional?
Yeah. It's a hugely interesting question. I couldn't wait to get to that chapter where I describe their first meeting at Monument Mountain. And even though they are diametrically opposed in so many ways, in terms of their life and their writing, nevertheless, they found connections, metaphysical not being the least of those connections. Melville found in Hawthorne what we might call a muse, a source of inspiration. When he first wrote the draft of Moby Dick, it was intended as a whaling adventure story. And then Melville said to him in so many words, I think you need to go deeper, plunge deeper. Think of the metaphysics of this, and then ended up with the epic novel we have. So Melville trusted Hawthorne. First of all, he trusted him because of the early reviews that Hawthorne had written in favor of Taipei, for example, in spite of, he was really slammed by critics early in his career, but he was one who understood him. And then Hawthorne likewise felt close to Melville. Sophia said, this is the first man to really understand my husband. So on a professional level, there was the connection. Mutual admiration society, supportive. He even dedicated Moby Dick to Hawthorne, as you know. There's that. On the personal side, I do explore the theory, the homoerotic theory, but I don't find any evidence for it, but I explain it. And when I say I don't find any evidence, I don't find any evidence for it in the work, number one, nor do I find even a remote reference to it in his letters. So mm-hmm. I think what's happening there, and that's just, you know, in the last 40 years that's been popping up, I think we're looking at Melville and Hawthorne through 21st or 20th century eyeglasses. I say to my students, we've got to take those glasses off. We have to put on 19th century glasses. Otherwise, we're going to misinterpret language, word choice, even the word gay, which mm-hmm. Melville uses, but in a very different context than we would use it today in the 21st century. So eyeglasses, we need to see them through 19th century. I'm very much an originalist when it comes to literary studies. That is, before I consider other interpretations, what did the writers mean? What did they mean with their language at the time? And that goes to the letters, and particularly one letter in which he is so emotional. Well, understandable, given the fact that Melville has been deemed all but crazy or mad by some of his readers. Here's somebody who understood him. Mm-hmm. I think that Hawthorne in some ways was, as the younger of the two, somewhat like a father figure to Melville, and one in whom he could trust, which indeed he did.
Well, this is not uncommon too, right? This
not uncommon.
The whole thing where we look at letters between people from the past, yeah, who are of the same gender that are very passionate, yeah, and like you said, may draw our own conclusions based on how we would say things now. And these are two romantics, right? These are two guys who make their whole name on kind of being dramatic.
Yeah.
And it's the epicness of everything.
Everything.
The stakes of, you know, the stakes of their lives. They're casting things in terms that we see now as, we see that intimacy as not being an intimate friendship. Mm. We see it as there being only one kind of intimacy that is that intense. And I think they saw a lot more gradation in that.
Yes, yes. Yeah, I have empathy for those who interpret their friendship otherwise. I just don't choose to agree with it, and I don't see the evidence for it. It doesn't mean that there's anything wrong, but it just seems like that's twisting out of recognizable shape. It's misrepresenting what the two men were all about as far as their friendship is concerned. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's all of our questions, but we want to go to our lightning round questions now.
Okay.
you can start us off, Allison.
Sure. So for our first lightning round question, if Nathaniel Hawthorne's life were to be dramatized and you got to pick the medium, which would you choose? A feature film biopic, an HBO miniseries, or an in-depth podcast series?
I picked the second because that's how he wrote. Each novel, each body of short fiction prepared us for the next one. And so there's a suspenseful note at the end of one body of work. And so we have a 6 or 8 part HBO miniseries by all means, probably structured around his work. One would be what's leading up to Fanshawe, then what leads up to and results in the Scarlet Letter and so forth. And then weaving into all that, of course, his various friendships, his family.
Excellent. I'd love to watch that. What would Nathaniel Hawthorne's pandemic project be?
Now, by pandemic project, you mean hobbies?
Yeah, you know, we were all making sourdough or knitting or doing puzzles,
yeah.
You know.
Well, what comes to mind is building furniture. You know, he built his tower after he returned from Europe. The third floor of his house where he retreated to do his work and built with his hands with the help of some construction folks that came in. So I could see him building furniture. He was very good at woodworking. Also perhaps tending to his garden, which Thoreau had planted for him. He liked to sail in his boat in the Concord River. So I could see him also refurbishing his boat and perhaps adding some instruments to it and taking it out. I think we're very much buried in the natural world. For Hawthorne, like many romantics, the natural world to which he was very close was a comfort, a guide, a teacher, a healer. And so anything having to do with the natural world, I think, would attract him during that time as well, where it's clean, it's pure, it's uncluttered, it's not poisoned by the urban life.
A lot of us did a lot of walking in the woods those early months. He would have been right out there with us.
Yeah.
Yeah. What if any form of social media would he have used? Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or TikTok?
Probably Facebook. He was interested in the daguerreotype. And the daguerreotype figures as an important symbol in his novels, capturing pictures and then adding a text to the pictures. And I see Facebook as kind of a modern version of daguerreotype, capturing the person facially. And then we hear, of course, the person's voice or see the text. So I think that would, I think he'd be a little overwhelmed by the more advanced TikTok or Instagram. He wasn't necessarily technologically prone, but I could see teaching him Facebook.
I like it.
Would he have
like
been
it.
Arguing in the comments, though? That's the question.
Probably not, unless it's something really riled him up. He tended to be keep his opinions to himself, but when he did speak, he would have something to say, but he wouldn't be caught up in the day-to-day chatter or what Cynthia Ozick calls the din of the crowd. He'd be caught up in that.
Good for him.
Yes.
Now, The Scarlet Letter has been adapted many, many times. But which work of Hawthorne's other than that would make the best modern movie or TV adaptation?
My first choice would be The House of the Seven Gables. It's all pictures. Really, every page is the creation of a picture. In fact, I have helped my students to memorize the plot by as a series of word picture associations. And once they have those two or three dozen pictures in their mind, they've got the entire plot. Next would be The Marble Faun, which is, again, it's set in Rome and Tuscany and is just rife with pictures created with words that would, I think, bring it alive. It's those two novels seem especially adaptable to that medium of television.
That would be great. It'd be nice for people to know more than just the Scarlet Letter of his.
So. Yes, I agree.
Well, thank you so much for being with us today. Can people find you somewhere online?
Yes, just look me up.
And you'll okay. find me.
Or you can reach me at Citrus College via email, just dsalwak@citruscollege.edu.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much.
I'm not hidden, so easy to find me.
Thank you so much for doing this. We really appreciate it.